What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. We're broadcasting at the Memorial Hermann's 15th Annual Sports Medicine Update. Running the show, for the most part, Dr. Josh Ellen from the University of Houston, Master of Athletic Training. There we go. And Dr. Kent, I really enjoyed your presentation. Hopefully you got some nice quick wit. Dr. Yellen, as part of the presentation, you wanted to ask a question, so quickly introduce yourself. Go ahead and ask your question, and go for it.
Sure. My name is Curtis Crawford. I'm a nurse practitioner, and I see quite a few ortho problems, especially in the elderly. And one of the main questions I had was, when do you progress from anti-inflammatories onto knee injections, steroids, Synvisc, and then, of course, onto knee replacement?
Yeah, so it's a great question. It's a real common question. A lot of patients come in asking specifically about that. You know, what do you think I should do? And really, you know, the disadvantage that I'm at when I'm talking to patients is that they're the ones that feel the pain. I don't feel the pain. And so I know a lot about the anatomy. I know a lot about the surgeries. I know a lot about the non-surgical treatment, things like that. But unfortunately, I don't feel their pain. So many times a decision as to where they are on that ladder, if you will, where are they just at the spot where therapy and anti-inflammatories are appropriate versus injections, a lot of times they will have come to me from the primary care office and they've already tried anti-inflammatories. They've already tried physical therapy. And so naturally with me, they may be candidates for injections earlier when they see me than when they see you. But a lot of times I give patients a choice. If they have a trip coming up and their knee is hurting real bad and I want to try and get them through the trip, I think a steroid injection is an absolutely wonderful alternative. If their baseline level of pain is at 3 and 4 and it's acceptable, but it's just not great for them, or they probably wouldn't be in to see you, I think that Synvisc or something like that, a visco supplement or lubricant type injection is very, very appropriate because it doesn't work right away, but it can have a longer lasting effect. And so many times though, I give the patient the choice. Radiographic findings, so if their x-rays look really, really bad, I may tell them, you know, your arthritis is really, really severe. I'm not sure that the visco supplement's going to be very helpful to you. Same with PRP and BMA, but the steroid injections many, many times are just kind of a time buyer, and I make them very well aware of that.
Thank you.
You bet.
All right. So one of my favorite things that I heard you say was the knee or the cartilage is kind of like the tread on a tire.
Mm-hmm.
You can't ever put tread back on the tire, but you can do things to lengthen it. So just a quick rundown, what are some of the top things we can do to lengthen the life of the tread or our cartilage?
Rotate every 5,000 miles.
That's right. Well, and you know, it's maintenance. It's just like that. I always tell folks will maintain alignment. They want to maintain balancing. They want to maintain appropriate tire pressure. And really, I can make this very simple. Maintain a healthy weight and stay active. Activity, if you have an arthritic knee, needs to be centered around low to mid impact sort of activities as opposed to jogging. Again, I'm not against jogging, but in the setting of arthritis, that does have a higher chance of aggravating the knee, and over a long period of time will degrade the cartilage more than a lower impact exercise. But the reverse is not true, that if you sit and do nothing, the tire is not going to wear, because to carry the analogy a little further, trailer tires. You don't use your trailer but once, let's say, every 3 or 4 months. And so those tires really have very few miles on them. But because they're not being used, they do have a higher chance of failure because the rubber is not as well maintained and it just doesn't get that daily use. And so, again, that activity level in between those two is very appropriate. Swimming, biking, elliptical trainer, walking are all very appropriate exercise to do. Weight training, nothing wrong with that whatsoever.
Is there any, you know, like when I was coming through, you know, when we were lifting for football or lifting for track or powerlifting, I was always taught squatting butt to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And then along came, that was Mike Barr, I think he fell over. And then, and then came, you know, some other research. Well, you know, you don't want to go past 90 degrees because mm-hmm. it's going to hurt your knees. What's some of this evidence that's out there about, you know, full squat, full range of motion? How does that affect, you know, the cartilage? Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence supporting for or against?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say there's any strong evidence that says that you shouldn't go beyond a certain degree. That being said, I think most people have adopted the fact that a 90-degree squat or with your knee bent to 90 is probably the most appropriate. It does all the things that you need to do. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't put a tremendous amount of pressure many times on the cartilage on the back side of the kneecap. That's the biggest deal, is that you put a tremendous amount of pressure there, and it doesn't necessarily wear it down abnormally just from doing that. But as we age, unfortunately, that cartilage wears, that tread goes away. And so it's really a matter of what are we doing to aggravate the knee, as opposed to just every time we do this squat that's a, you know, going all the way down to the ground, that we're just taking years off of the lifespan of our knee. That's not what's going on. It's really just a matter of aggravating some pre-existing damage that is prone to happen just because you've used your knees. Squats are still a great exercise. Lunges are still a great exercise. There seems to be a major resurgence of those in every personal training or CrossFit
right, because
type
of this
workout,
more emphasis on functional movement and functional training.
And I think that and I think that's really critical, because what they're doing most of the time with these exercises is just engaging the core.
Right.
And you know what, we always go back to that core, right? And it's tremendously important. By no means am I again saying that squats and lunges are bad, but in the setting of arthritis, it is something that can potentially aggravate it a little more.
So one of the questions that I typically get is that, you know, I've got some knee pain, right? And I went to CVS Pharmacy and I got this brace, right? And to me, it's like, okay, well, if that makes you feel better, that's fine. What's your stance on that?
So it can be helpful. Now, the problem with arthritis is not that the knee is unstable, and so providing some external support, unless it's an offloading brace, really is not doing anything to enhance the stability. However, a pitcher comes off the mound, he's sweating and has just pitched for an inning, and what's the first thing he does? He puts a jacket on his throwing
arm,
right? And he wants to keep it warm. And so what he's trying to avoid is, I'm hot while I'm throwing, I'm cold while I'm sitting in the dugout, I'm hot while I'm throwing. And so he's trying to avoid those changes. And so I think that bracing can be effective in that regard, that if you have a job where, you know, you walk from parking lot into your desk and then you sit for 4 hours, well, it's something that it can help somewhat, but it's just helping symptoms. It's not mediating anything as far as a disease is concerned.
Right. And so let's talk a little bit about the offloading brace for those that are listening. What's the difference between the brace that I would get at CVS Pharmacy, at Kroger Pharmacy, you know, that I borrowed from my friend, versus the offloading brace?
Yeah, so an offloading brace is not trying to provide stability per se. It's trying to realign the leg. And so typically there's really only two deformities that a knee will go through, and by far becoming more bow-legged is definitely more common. And so most of the braces are trying to push you out of that bow-legged deformity into something that is a more normal alignment. And so it purposely is pushing you in a direction, as opposed to trying to provide support for, say, a ligament that's out or a ligament that's healing that's just been fixed.
And so along those lines, Lynn, let's say that, you know, your presentation was really when young athletes become older athletes, right? And so, and in your mind, when does that transition happen? Is that happening in the 20s, in the 30s, in the 40s?
It just depends on the patient. And you know, I opened my talk, you know, basically saying that, gosh, 65 used to be really, really old, whereas now it's not so much anymore, you know? And so it's, unless you're Mike Farah, but ultimately it's one of those things that that it really is determined by activity. I have really amazing patients that I aspire to be at some point in my life, and so it really I wish I could say an age per se. All that I'll say that applies, you know, as a 40-year-old in my life, it's just to say that instead of me taking a 20-year-old mentality and saying I've been sitting on my butt for a summer eating Cheetos and ice cream on the couch, I'm going to whip myself into shape over a two-week period. It's more important that we maintain, again, that level of health all along, so we have that foundation there, and that as we move into, there's nothing wrong with CrossFit, there's nothing wrong with P90X or Orange Theory or any of these various things. It's just to say that as we get older, we have to transition into them, as opposed to say, I've got 10 pounds I want to lose, and that's how I'm going to achieve it. Because most of the time, those folks will come to me 2 and 3 and 4 weeks later and say, gosh, I've been hurting real bad. Well, did you start a new workout program? Well, yeah, I started such and such, and so because of that. So I wish I could pin it down to a certain age, but ultimately I think we're at our peak physiologically at 25. And so the quick and easy answer, which I'm not obviously very good at, is probably after 25, things really start to break down.
Yeah, I'm 42, and I can –
Me and you both.
Yeah, I'm 42.
Yes,
and
sir.
It's, man, boy, did I just fall off. These are bifocals, progressive. And then I'm starting to catch Mike. And then they said I need a hearing aid to my left ear.
I'd like to interject here. when we asked Dr. Kent to talk, the purpose I had in mind, exactly what he gave, that when we
Mike, didn't even turn on your microphone.
Oh, man, that's a bummer. Okay. Oh. Is that when
they just muted it.
When we were looking for speakers for the conference, my idea was that we have coaches and, you know, parents and grandparents are always asking us about, well, could you look at my knee? And I thought, you know what, this is a good idea that we bring someone in who really this is their field, this is what they do on a daily basis. It isn't something that we would just guess at, or we could just, you know, throw something to the wall, see if it sticks.
Uh-huh.
You know, when Dr. Kent was anointed to be part of the Ironman Sports Medicine Institute in Sugar Land, you know, everybody thinks this is a sports medicine clinic, number one. Well, that's true, and that's the goal they're trying to get there, but you're going to see athletes of all ages. And for someone to be inactive because their knee's killing them, you know, kind of defeats the purpose of having a clinic like that. So that was one of the reasons that we asked Dr. Kent to talk about what he did. I mean, you know, I'm 61. You know, my knee's fine. I had ACL reconstruction years ago. Nothing hurts me, but I'm not active, so I'm not in that group. But I enjoy walking. I enjoy walking in the refrigerator to the bathroom, to the truck.
Multiple, you know, times.
So it's all good with me, but I see when I go out to visit schools, I'll end up evaluating a coach, you know, male or female. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Kent's right about, you know, body mass index and, you know, habits. Do they smoke? Do they drink or whatever? They're all ex-athletes. You know, they can't do what they used to do and they're frustrated. And you right away suggest, well, let's go see somebody. You know, well, who are you going to see? Well, that's why we brought them up here. We want to put the face out there, you know, of someone who's very good at what they do. So when you refer these people in, you know, they're going in and they don't think exactly what he gave the example of. I'm going to make a cut here, and the middle part's gone. And that's just not what it is. The technology is much greater now than it was, what,
mm-hmm.
5 years ago, 10 years ago?
Major changes in the past 5 years in the way patients are recovering. And just to further your point, I've injected far more coaches in training rooms than I have athletes.
And so I want to talk about that transition right after 25, moving into your 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, et cetera. So what are some of the tips? Obviously, you said before, it's a lot like tread on a tire, stay active, keep your mm-hmm. weight down, mm-hmm. you know, all those other things. But what are some other types of things that you are seeing that could, you know, help the listeners communicate with their patients, et cetera, mm-hmm. of how to really preserve the knee, right? So one of the examples I have, one of my mentors in California, Dr. Jerry Bornstein, retired orthopedic surgeon, 85 years old,
mm-hmm.
still plays tennis every day,
mm-hmm.
and skis every winter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's amazing. He's like Yoda. He's going to live forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so what are some of these things that you're seeing? Because you're talking about you know, these older athletes,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, how do we keep on preserving this?
Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't go any further than staying active and maintaining a healthy weight. We can't help. Unfortunately, it's the genetic side that gets a lot of us, is that if mom and dad had knee replacements, or mom or dad had knee replacements, well, there's a good chance that you're going to need a knee replacement. It's not saying for sure you're going to,
mm-hmm.
But you can't alter that genetic side, unfortunately. We're just not at that spot. Now, we've got a guy in the department, Dr. Heward, who is working daily, who's a world-renowned guy that is actually working on things just like this, to say, well, we might not be able to reverse changes, but at least we can say, okay, this is what your knee looks like at 40. If we can capture that, well, then potentially we can allow it to stay at 40. So there's things on the horizon. I don't think it's going to happen, or it's not going to happen overnight. But there's certainly a lot of work being done that way. But as a patient, what I'd tell you about your mentor is that he's just a blessed guy, mm-hmm. you know, is that to be able to continue to ski and continue to play tennis and things like that at that age, that's just because he has great genes, but we're seeing more and more of it. And I think as we maintain, hopefully try to maintain a healthier weight, stay active, well, there's going to be a lower incidence. Or instead of patients coming to me at 55 for a knee replacement, they're going to be 75, you mm-hmm. know. And so again, what used to be old has changed quite a bit. And so when I was in residency, which wasn't that long ago, I mean, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, the thought of doing a knee replacement on somebody that was in their 80s was just completely and totally foreign to me. Mm-hmm. I have zero problems with operating on a healthy 80-year-old at this point. And it's not because I'm trying to take everybody to the operating room. It's merely to say that folks can get better. And if their heart's good, your mind's good, your will is there, mm-hmm. and your knees are holding you back, well, maybe we can fix it, you know, as long as everything checks out. And so a lot of this, unfortunately, is out of patients' control, whether it be diabetes and, well, smoking obviously is in their control. But there are things like that that obviously will alter the lifespan of the joint as they play into weight or otherwise.
What are your criteria for, you know, you've got, let's say, a weekend warrior, and, you know, they were an athlete in high school, maybe an athlete in college. They're going to do some of the Ironmans. They're mm-hmm. really wearing that cartilage down. Mm-hmm. What are some criterias, or what's the algorithm that you use to get to the point of, you know what, this is going to be a knee replacement? The reason why I ask is, you know, my dad had a total hip, and mm-hmm. really the orthopedic surgeon had said, look, it's really a quality of life issue. Mm-hmm. Is that still kind of the gold standard? Or
it is. Know? It is, because, you know, my triathletes, I have done triathletes for years, and so and have worked with the running company out in the area where I practice, and love those folks, and the folks come in. I do basically a free clinic just to talk with them about things, and some of them every once in a while come to clinic, and I look at their x-rays, and I'm actually amazed at what they're doing. But you know, if somebody comes to me and says, my knee is really hurting, I want you to replace it so I can run marathons, I'm going to say that's probably not a realistic expectation. Because after a knee replacement, I tell folks, I don't want you running for exercise. It's okay to run as long as you're being chased. It's not like the implant itself is going to explode if you run on it. It's just to say that as far as wear is concerned, it's not a real good way to treat an artificial or, you know, a prosthetic knee. And so I have to set expectations coming on, you know. But I've had patients, again, they come in to see me, and I'm amazed at how bad their x-rays look, yet they're still doing these superhuman feats, whether mm-hmm. it's, you know, triathlons in general, or certainly half Ironmans, Ironmans, marathons, half marathons, things like that, that I'm impressed. And my word to them is, you know, at some point your knee's going to tell you can't do that anymore. And a knee replacement's not going to say, okay, all of a sudden. I talked in the auditorium there about a young lady that was in her 30s that had played basketball for years. She was still in the coaching profession, and she said, okay, doc, just go ahead and replace my knee because I need to get back to coaching and playing basketball the way I used to. And it took me back a little bit, because I began to understand she truly was under the impression that if I gave her or went through a knee replacement with her, that she was going to be like she was 16 years old again. Mm-hmm. It's a good way for us to understand I'm not God, you know, and again, I'm not trying to, you know, be overly emphatic with that, but merely just to say is that this is still an artificial joint. Normal knees don't get operated on. Whether mm-hmm. it's an ACL reconstruction or a knee replacement, there's still a reason that you're getting operated on, and so ultimately I'm trying to recreate something that was created in a much better way prior to me being involved. However, we're trying to restore quality of life.
And so...
Real quick, do you have Twitter?
No, I apologize.
You said just along those lines, you mm-hmm. said it's metal, it's plastic, and it's cement. It's really fancy metal, plastic, and cement, but it's still metal, plastic, and cement. So that's exactly what you were saying. Mm-hmm. It's just not real. It's not normal. So
that's correct.
I was going to mention you in that tweet that I already sent out.
Yeah, I apologize. I feel like I'm too old for all that stuff. Either that, or I just don't have the time, or don't take the time for it. It would be smart. I'm sure I could add a lot to those feeds.
So in your practice in general, if I were to break up in terms of percentages when you're working on knees, mm-hmm. the majority of your operations are knee replacements, ACL reconstruction?
Knee replacements, by far. Probably 85% of my practice now is knee replacements.
And do you have some data on the average age of the knee replacement, the average gender, that kind of stuff?
So male, it's a little more common, in females. Believe it or not, the right knee is more common than the left knee, and as far as a dialed in age, I would say it used to be probably in the lower 60s, but that's climbing up somewhat well, I shouldn't say the age is climbing up, because unfortunately obesity is causing that age to go down, but anywhere from about 55 on, not uncommon to be in there for a knee replacement. Obviously the younger patients, I don't want to rush right to surgery, because even though we have good survivorship at 20 years, that's still not to say we ought to just put it in everybody and hope mm-hmm. that it lasts, because another operation carries with it higher complication rates, and so we don't want to subject patients to that, or just another operation, even if everything goes just wonderfully well. So my younger patients, I'm going to push a little harder. Force wouldn't be the right word, but certainly push a little harder to make sure they've gone through every non-operative regimen that we have out there. to make sure we can say wholeheartedly, you know, I'm ready to go. But patients come to see me because they're having trouble getting on and off the toilet. They hate getting in and out of the car. Mm-hmm. They don't like getting up after sitting at their desk for a while. They dread going to sleep at night because they're not going to sleep well at night because of their knee. And so many of these things, again, it's not I can't run a marathon. It's I can't get off the toilet without hurting. And that, mm-hmm. that'll really, you know, that'll no, bring you to day. See the doctor,
yeah.
you know.
No. And so let's transition now from they came to see you, you provide the surgical intervention, and let's kind of move into rehab.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously rehabbing a prosthetic implant is a little bit different than rehabbing a normal anatomical structure.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of your parameters? That, you know, I've always said, you know, rehab, the surgeon is like the contractor. Comes in, lays the foundation, puts the wood up for the house, and then tell somebody like me, okay, you put up the drywall and paint it and make it, you know, mm-hmm. and that's it. But you're really the one that's dealing with the structure.
Sure.
What are some of your parameters? What is the progress that you want to look for? Mm-hmm. What are some of the outcomes that you want to see?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And things have actually changed significantly in the past 2 years of my practice. And it really boils down to pain control following the surgery. If we do a better job at controlling pain, well, then the next day, instead of you know, me seeing a patient in the hospital that wants to kill me because they're hurting so bad, they're smiling. They're in their normal clothes. Women have makeup on. Their hair is fixed. They have a brighter face. And I know that sounds kind of corny, but that's just the reality of it. Many patients are complaining of a pain level of zero. The day of surgery, we're making them walk. And so mm-hmm. what we used to do in day two and three therapy-wise after surgery, we're doing now the day of surgery. Patients used to stay in the hospital 3 or 4 days. Now they're going home the next day. In fact, we're just on the verge of turning this into an outpatient procedure, which, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, the vast majority of the world would not have even imagined that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therapy is critical, and I tell patients that over and over and over again. I make them very well aware that I am a member of the team. They're part of the team. The therapist is a critical member of the team. And then I, again, my job is to make things, like you said, structurally sound.
Mm-hmm.
I owe them great surgery. They need to get out of there knowing that their knee is aligned appropriately, that it bends, it straightens, all the stuff that it's supposed to do. But it's very easy for me to do that while they're asleep.
Mm-hmm.
When they wake up, that's their job and it's your job, you know, to make them move. So what I used to expect at 6 weeks was that they could flex the knee to around 90 degrees, that their quad function had recovered, and that they were getting around without an assistive device. What's happened with our new protocols, because therapists have grabbed onto it and are so wonderful at getting patients better, now at 2 weeks when people are coming back to see me, a lot of times they're not using a cane, they're not using a walker. They come walking in without any assistive device. They're already bending to 100 degrees at 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So what I used to expect at 6 weeks is now happening at two. What I used to expect at 3 months is happening at 6 weeks. Patients are getting discharged from therapy. I've had a guy that went to 3 weeks of therapy, and they said, man, you don't need to be here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's unheard of following a knee replacement. I used to tell patients 3 months, and I still tell them expect about 3 months of therapy because I want them to know, again, how important that is. And I tell them routinely, if you don't want to do therapy, don't do this surgery because mm-hmm. I'm nothing without a great therapist and a great patient who's willing to go through this. And what they go through, fortunately, these days seems to be a little less, again, not downplaying the size of the operation or the recovery itself, but it has gotten better. And so patients that are scared to go through the surgery because they're concerned about the therapy and the pain following it, it is changing.
Mm-hmm. A lot, you know, becoming more and more efficient. We're learning more and more about the body.
Mm-hmm.
We're learning how well we can push it. You know, and what you said, pain control is
critical.
Just phenomenal.
Well, and making patients aware, I have to tell patients, again, what he was talking about earlier is that the metal, plastic, and cement comment, I tell them that over and over and over again because at some point that will click in their head, which is, I'm not going to mess this up. You're not mm-hmm. going to break it. I tell them that over and over. You're not going to break the implants, and so use them. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm all for that. That's why we make you get up the day of surgery, whereas some of the ligament reconstructions or the tendon repairs and things like that, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with those things, but we have to protect that repair a little bit. Well, the surfaces, the cement, all that stuff's as hard as it's ever going to be within 24 hours of the operation, and so it's very reasonable for us to expect or ask patients, let's put full weight on this right away. They're going to use a walker. They need stuff for stability and safety, so we're not throwing those to the wind, but it's merely to say the implants will tolerate it as long as you can tolerate it, and
right.
So if you can tolerate it, we're gonna build on that.
So this is really about, you know, the outcomes are obviously a very talented surgeon, and making sure that we have a good rehabilitation protocol in front of us, and making sure that the patient, you know, if I really look at this in terms of percentages, 33, 33, 33, or, you know, however that works out, that that patient has to own as much of this responsibility as the healthcare team, and they're going to have to be able to push themselves, and they're going to have to, you know, deal with the pain and do the home exercises and follow the protocols and do exactly what's told.
Absolutely. And all of my patients go to a joint education class, and so they're required. I hate to say required. They're strongly recommended to go to a joint education class where they meet the therapist. The therapist actually, prior to surgery, give them the exercises that they're going to be doing afterwards and say, this is what we expect you to do beforehand. We give them handouts. Memorial Hermann has been great about printing a very, very detailed book about this sort of stuff, so we can give them some homework so they, again, go into this knowledgeable. But they know going into this that therapy is absolutely critical, and without that, myself, the patient, are not going to be successful.
Yeah, before we end, one of the best pieces of advice that I ever got when I was in graduate school was have them do the exercises before they go in for surgery. And I thought, well, sure, prehab, you know, that totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. And the surgeon I was working with said, no, psychologically, they'll know exactly what to expect when you get out. Mm-hmm. So there are no surprises. So they already know, okay, I just went through surgery, I'm in some pain, but oh, I've done this before. Mm-hmm. And that I can see it, and I know exactly what to expect. Absolutely. And that we push through that psychological aspect faster. Mm-hmm. And we're able to get them to recover faster.
Absolutely.
This has been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.